from the basic delta of eastern Arkansas, the delta of southeast Arkansas, pine trees of western, southwestern, up through these gorgeous Boston Mountains. A sports team is an intangible. It's intangible. And consequently, a team lives at the behest of the men and women who played on it for years before and are going to play on it in years to come.
There's so much passion in this state for the Razorbacks, it's second to none in my opinion.
You know what really impresses me every time I come to Baum Stadium is the atmosphere. It's the people, it's the music, this is just a fun place to watch a game.
Our goal, in all honesty, is to make the people of Arkansas proud, because this is a proud damn state.
Played a couple good videos for you from the Arkansas basketball Twitter account, and this one comes courtesy of just the Razorbacks Twitter account, but Jerry Jones was the narrator of that clip. You heard from Eric Musselman, you heard from Tom Hart of the SEC Network talking about Baum Stadium, and then you ended it with a quote from Sam Pittman, how this is a damn proud state. And we'll get into this conversation more coming up, because I was really blown away by the video and everything that went into it yesterday. They did a fantastic job, and it's definitely something I want to get into coming up in this segment. I talked to you about this before we came on. University of Arkansas has raised $311,000 for...
I saw this email from Kevin Trainer that came out yesterday, that when the baseball season ended, the university gave you a choice, a couple different options. You could take a refund, put the money back in your pocket. You could donate it towards a building fund. You could also donate some of the money towards coronavirus, COVID-19 relief efforts. And there's over $300,000 with Arkansas fans that decided to leave the money in the kitty and let it help others.
And that ties into our conversation. So you heard, again, the quote from Sam Pittman, if I could say it, Sam Pittman, how this is a damn proud state. And I couldn't agree more. We had Cindy Moncrief on earlier this week, and he was talking about how there were stories of him being asked if they had shoes in Arkansas. They were so shocked because he was wearing shoes, and he said he was from Arkansas. And there's still this impression out there that dates as early as back to when I went to New York in 2003 for Thanksgiving, and people were questioning me about if we had electricity or shoes in 2003.
Well, 2003, you were still in a stroller. You may not have had shoes on in 2003.
I mean, I was 6 or 7.
Oh,
when, I wasn't that.
So you were in diapers, just not in a stroller. Okay, I got you.
I think I've got out of diapers at 2 years old. I think I can't remember the last time I've wet my bed. Hopefully it's been
two weeks ago.
It hasn't been 2 weeks ago. I promise you that. But this idea.
Three weeks ago.
Okay, whatever. I'll take it. So this idea that this is a very proud state, I think it has a little bit to do us being in the South. I think it has to do a little bit of kind of what you heard from Sydney, the conversation I brought up, and the fact that you're always looked down upon for whatever reason, just because you're Arkansas, you go about things different way, things move a little slower in the South, which I think is good in a lot of ways, because I don't really like the pace and the pace and hustle that occurs in New York, Chicago. I know it's a little slower out in Los Angeles, but the traffic out there, there's a lot of things that I really enjoy about living in Arkansas that some outside of the state might look down upon. But one of the things that you've been quite proud of some time is the Arkansas Razorbacks. And that can vary amongst different sports. Whether it's the baseball team being one of the best in the country, the basketball team at one point being one of the best in the country, and the football team at one point being one of the most storied programs in the country. Now, those have occurred in different years. Tommy and I always discuss on this show that the football team and the basketball team can never seem to line up and have good seasons together. It's always one or the other. Now, the baseball team has been so consistent, they usually team alongside with either the football team or the basketball team, depending on the year. That being said, you still don't ever seem to get a lineup where the football team, the basketball team, and the baseball team is good, but that seldom happens in college sports in general. But the idea is that you're proud of being a Razorback. I know that a lot of you really like to support Razorback Red, whether it's inside the state, whether it's outside the state, wherever you are going on vacation. I mean, it's wild some of the stories I've heard of Hog fans meeting. When I was in Nashville last July, we were at a bar and we were swearing Razorback stuff, and this older gentleman came up to us, probably mid-50s. I was like, wait, he just said, "Woo pig," and we said, "Woo pig." And then he came back with a bucket of beers and just like, "Here you go, boys," and just walked off. And like, and it's just like we can't shake. We shook hands then. We can't shake hands now. But that's just one of those things where it's a camaraderie. It's like a fraternity of Arkansas fans that goes beyond time.
We all feel sorry for each other.
Yeah. So especially in this time right now. And I think
we've all lived through the heartache.
Yeah, which is so painful. And I think, I mean, I always hear stories of how great things used to be with the basketball program. And again, I can only read, I can only watch as many highlights, as many previous games as possible. But until you actually experience it, you don't know what it's like. Tommy, I don't know if I've told you this story, but one of my friends, her parents wanted her to go to a school that was going to compete for a national championship because they were both enrolled during the 90s when Arkansas won it. And they said there's never been anything like it. So they literally told her, "I want you to," and she ended up choosing Arkansas, and unfortunately that didn't happen outside of the baseball team. But they said, "I want you to go to a school where you can experience what we did when we were in school." And I thought that was kind of cool, and the fact that that was kind of their reasoning, because, I mean, you were around in the 90s. I know that you went to Arkansas Tech, but you've grown up a Razorback fan your entire life, and I can only imagine what that would have been like actually seeing it firsthand occur and just everything that went along with that.
Got a lot of friends that were around up there. You know, some people went to school with that were a year or so ahead of me in high school that were, you know, in that environment. Yeah, it's special. You know, unless you go to a perennial power, unless you're going to Alabama, which their enrollment picked up when their football program success became consistent. That's why people say Saban, and they're accurate when they say it, is worth three times the money they're paying and what he brings to the university. That's absolutely right. Because you're right, people inherently, there's enough of them at least, are front runners. You know, that's why you go from live in Michigan, grow up in Michigan, want to go to school in Alabama. Or a school, a state in the Northeast, or just, I mean, it's not really, it's a national thing.
It's a lot of Jersey kids that have found the way to Bama. It's weird.
But, you know, that's inherent, I think, in a lot of people that you want to be around success. And you want to, you know, you want to be able to forever say you were a graduate of a university that's had success on the field. We take pride in that as sports fans, as Americans.
And we talked about that a little bit yesterday, how one of the reasons it's important for the Arkansas football, baseball, and basketball team to be successful, not only for its current state, but future as well. Because what do kids growing up want to see? Winning. What do they also want to see? Their in-state programs win. Because if they grow up Razorback fans, it's also tied along with the fact that the teams have been good. It's harder in today's day and age with my generation, the generation below, to stick with the losing teams. That's why you see more bandwagon fans, more fair weather fans in today's day and age, because some of you out there listening, whichever your team is, whether you've had to cheer for the lowly Cleveland Browns over the years, baseball, I know for many years my buddy was an Athletics fan, and he just went through misery after misery with the seasons that occurred. Think about the Cubs fans that have had to go through the turmoil they did before they finally won the World Series a couple years back. You just don't see that as much anymore. It's not as prevalent when you look at today, because there's just more fan of the fan. And that's why it's important, not only for the current state of Arkansas athletics, but for the future, for the fandom and the athletes themselves. Let's go to the phone lines, 877-377-6963. JW is in London. He's wanting to talk a little football. JW, you're on the Morning Rush.
Good morning. Happy Good Friday to you.
Happy Good Friday.
Happy Good Friday to you as well.
I am, gentlemen, you know as much as I do how important college football is to the financing of all the sports. You know, well, baseball is Arkansas, baseball, basketball, and football is always going to be able to support themselves. But all the other sports depend on the revenue, primarily from football, if you get right down to it. My suggestion, and tell me what you think about this idea, because it may not be a good idea. I really don't think by the beginning of football season, August, this is all going to be over and we're just going to be able to do whatever we want to. But I think a lot of us who've been sheltering in place and doing all the things that we need to do to limit contact with other people, by August, I think we'll feel a little bit more comfortable about a close group of friends. So what I would like to see them do is go ahead and have the schedule, the full schedule, but just don't have any fans in the stands. Just don't have no one goes, but you still get the football revenue. You can watch it at home with a select group of small friends, and you can do that. I depend, because of I'm a writer and an artist and musician, I depend on sports to get me away from that as a part of my escape.
Yeah.
And all the things you said about this state being a proud state, it doesn't matter. I'm an ATU graduate. My masters are from there. My sons are, too. But we're still Razorback fans to the core. I mean, and you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Anyway, if you all would just tell me what you think about that idea.
Well, here's what I think.
I love listening to y'all. You're a really intelligent group of sports broadcasters, and I hope you all survive this whole mess we're going through. Thanks for taking my call.
Now, who are the intelligent ones, J.W.? I want to be clear on that. You know. Hey, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call. Have a great Easter.
If you had an ATU graduate there, I guarantee you he's a smart guy.
I appreciate the call, and have a great Easter. You know, the thing is, 95% of the fans don't attend the games, 98%. It's only a small fraction that actually buy a ticket and go in the games, because there's hundreds of thousands of fans that don't attend the games. There's only 70,000, 76,000 that can technically fit in the stadium. What do the vast majority of the fans do on a game day? They listen on the radio and they watch on TV. So if we go back to sports, as JW's talking, with no fans in the stands, for the vast majority, it will be weird, but how do most of us consume sports anyway? 99% of the games we watch or we consume are not in person. I mean, I would much rather settle and know I can't attend the game in person this year, but I can watch them all on TV or watch most of them on TV, than not have it at all.
I think
the idea of not having it because fans can't go, that needs to be taken off the table now.
Most fans would make that sacrifice. I think it was ESPN that came out with the report yesterday that said 72 or 76, I'm forgetting the exact percentage, said that if colleges weren't allowed student backs, the fans would not go to the games. I'm forgetting the exact factor, but I think a lot of fans, and I think the majority of college football, and would give up going to the games just to have them play. But then that begs the question, well, if you're not going to put the audience at risk, why would you put the players at risk?
Well, because leagues like the SEC or professional leagues like the NFL can afford this testing that's developed and being developed as we speak, that they can test players, they can test the referees, coaches, all the people you got to have to make sure a game goes on. This rapid testing that's out, you can make sure it's safe with a small group of a few hundred people, the participants, limit who gets in and who, you know, and you can still do the social distancing with the non-essential personnel you're going to let in, whether it's media or however you handle it. Would you rather have that and go through those steps? The SEC can afford that, right? So would you rather do that than not have any game to watch?
I mean, I would, but you're also getting the morality of the issue. What if one thing screws up and then you're risking the potential of a lot of players that happen?
If we're going to wait for a risk-free situation, we're never going to play again.
That's fair. And I mean,
if we're waiting on risk-free, why do we get in cars? Why do we fly on planes? I mean, I know this is a contagious situation that we have not dealt with before, but I think we're also finding the research is it's not been near as lethal and as deadly, because the fatalities to this point, with the data we're seeing now, hasn't been as extreme as the projections first were that led us to some of the decisions that shelter in place in most states. Now, maybe you can also make the argument the sheltering in place and the shutdown of sports and all of these is what's helped contain the spread. But at some point, we have to come out of our shelter-in-place world and live life again. At some point, the cure is going to be worse than the disease. and the destruction of everything else. And again, I'll go back to something I said 30 minutes ago. Until we go back to work with confidence in the plurality and the majority of this country, we don't even, I mean, we can talk about sports here because that's our lane. This is our venue. But the first indicator's got to be that the majority of Americans in most places geographically are getting back to work in some sense of normalcy. Because if we like, whether we like it or not, sports is still a luxury for all of us. Now, we may think it's a little higher in this audience here where we gather in our community each morning here on the Morning Rush. We probably put a little higher priority on it than society in general. That's why we're here together. This is our clubhouse. But the reality is we got 17 million Americans out of work because everybody's afraid to go out, and a lot of restaurants, well, nearly every restaurant in the country is operating vastly different than they were before. And we got to return a lot of those things in life to normalcy before we can think about getting sports back to just half normal. It's just playing.
Chris and Harrison asked the question, how many Broyles Matthew level donations do you think they could get if they're the only ones let into a football game?
I can't answer that because I'm not a Broyles Matthews donor. Don't have that kind of dough to throw to the university. But I'm going to tell you, a lot of these people that give that kind of money, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 a year and more, they're worried about rebuilding their business right now. These are doctors that, in a lot of cases, have not been able to work in 30 days. They've had to lay off all of their nurses and all the people that helped them build their practice. You know, you think about who these Broyles Matthews people are. They're business owners and operators. And I don't know, 8 out of 10 categories I've come in touch with, 9 out of 10 this last month, they're all hurting. So I think the last thing on their mind when all this lifts is, you know, could I pay a little extra to get some privilege here?
Clay's going to join us in about 15 minutes, and he wrote an article recently on Jim Counts, who happens to now be in the medical world. And like you're saying, he is not operating because that's of what's going on right now. So that's a perfect example.
I got two good friends that are dentists, and they've been shut down for, I guess, close to a month, 3 weeks now. You know, I know some people that work in that field, dental hygienist people, they never dreamed they'd be laid off. So, I mean, I'm just saying a lot of people that fit into this category that Chris was asking about are people that are going to have to get their business re-going again.
So they don't necessarily have the money to donate to begin with.
I mean, right now it's going to be, but I'm just time, energy, and focus. Where's that going to be placed? You know, just depending on when this lifts. Now, you know, by September, we may all have a different perspective and attitude. You know, I still believe this idea that America and the world, all the resources in the world can't come up and produce a vaccine within 18 months. Now, maybe this is out of my lane. I don't know the first thing about a vaccine other than they give you a shot and put it in your arm. Beyond that, I know nothing. But does it just make sense to you, Ty, that the world, the best resources in the world, can't figure out how to do it a little faster? Mass production of some sort? I don't know.
I got no answers.
That's when we're going to feel comfortable.
Do you see what, is it Dr. Fauci or Fauci? Is that how you pronounce his name?
The guy with the National Institute of Health? Yeah, Dr. Fauci?
Dr. Fauci. Okay, did you see what he said? That he thinks that we shouldn't shake hands anymore this?
That's not going to happen. We, as a majority, appreciate the human touch, the human interaction. If we can't shake hands, high five for the rest of our lives... I mean, that's a guy that's what's the technical term for what he does? He's a epidemiologist or something like that. I think that's the technical
term. I got no answers.
He's an epidemiologist. We'll just say it really fast and it'll sound smart. I mean, all these infectious disease people think you should live in a bubble anyway. So I can't imagine we're going to live the rest of our lives in a world where we don't shake hands.
Does that mean you can't have sex with your significant other either?
If you're married, you don't worry about that anyway. So
I mean, oh man, I'd love to. I think most married men and married women would say their sex life is increased. Since
JT says he's a germaphobe. Well, that's another. I don't know that that's a scientific term, JT, but. I don't know. To your question, we've been wondering whether there was going to be more babies born out of this or more divorces out of this. I think it's neck and neck right now. It may be a photo finish.
It's a combination of both.
Maybe you have to go to the photo.
I don't know. Yeah, like you said earlier, the divorce lawyer business is probably, and what did you say, the divorce lawyer, and what was the other thing that's probably?
Liquor stores. I think liquor stores are booming right now.
Well, we saw a percentage. I know we got this email, Tommy, last week or so, that there's this one county in Pennsylvania that liquor stores are up 1,000%, I think, across the board in the United States.
1,000?
Yeah, 1,000%. There's a liquor stores across the United States are up like 40%. And what, I don't know if it's the RIB or what website we got it from, they said that people are practicing drunking in place.
Yeah.
Drunking in
place. Well, we got a list of categories of businesses that are doing well out of this, and that was like the first one on the list.
Liquor stores.
Yeah.
So, because people are just, they're not hoarding the liquor, but they're
needing. They're not. It's not that they're hoarding. They're just consuming too much.
And I know that you and I don't drink during the program. I don't drink during the week. You drink every night, but.
Well, I drink every night because of this program.
Yeah, because of this program. Yeah. But I have several, I don't know about you, but I have several of my cohorts that work at home, and they sip on a beer or two while they're doing their work, because why not?
And loosen you up a little bit, a little more creative.
So I don't, I do not, from Sunday till 8:59 a.m. on Friday, I do not consume alcohol of any sort, and I get ridiculed for it every single time we go out. That's legitimate. You can ask anyone. Tommy, you're, why are you pressing against that? You make fun of me every single time we go out during the week, and you get one
of
your.
I think that's a laugh. I think,
that's just true.
What's your process of making this decision?
Right now, I'm just taking day by day. There's really a good chance that I'm going to stay in the draft and just take on bigger challenges dealing with God and how everything went this year. I feel like Coach Mustin put me in a good position where I can go out there and continue my journey and continue to show what my worth is. And I feel like I just want to thank Coach Mustin and the coaching staff for just, just doing everything they did for me this year and just showing me the ropes. Right now in my journey, it's time for bigger challenges, and I'm ready to accept them and see where God takes me.
So to be clear, you haven't hired an agent yet?
No, sir, I haven't.
That was from our interview with Mason Jones yesterday. If you want to listen to it in its entirety, you can go to hitthatline.com, our SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Clay, I got a chance to talk with Bill Muse yesterday, who over at Connor State, the former coach of Mason Jones. And I wanted to just kind of get his insight, and he said that I was cool to share this on the program today. And he talked about how he felt like Mason grew as a player on and off the court at his time at Connor State. He was determined to prove people wrong his whole life because he had a lot of doubters. And he credited Mason eating Chipotle 3 times a day to how he lost weight, which I thought was kind of funny. But to the conversation of him growing as a player on and off the court, what did you see in his 2 years of Arkansas? And I mean, technically he could come back. It just sounds like the tone that he's had with us through the social media and stuff that he's probably going to stay in the NBA. How did you see him grow as a person both on and off the court at Arkansas?
Well, he did both, and I think that you saw in his attitude, that less and less this year that he would get into a funk because of something, an official's call or, a bad break or something, that happened that didn't go his way. That, I think his first year, he could sulk a little bit, and he seemed to, when those moments happened this year, he seemed to use that as fuel to play better. There was one point this year where I guess it was, the kind of talking back to Coach Musselman at the Missouri game, that would be the one time where you saw that little flash of immaturity. But by and large, that what you saw from him was growth over a 2-year period, both in the ability to score, the determination to play better defense, to adjust, and just the idea that he grew up, and he not only did he become a man, he wanted to be the man for that team. And he was a far different player this year than he was last year. And what I give him credit for is if you just kind of go back all the way to the academy in Missouri that he was at before the junior college, every coach over a four-year period gave him something, and he took it and he grew. Mm-hmm. Whether when he first started losing the weight, and then, you know, just different things that each one of those coaches would say that you need to do this. And some of it might have been regard to his faith, you know, his religious heart that just grew and grew and grew. And I think we sometimes overlook that in the development of players, young men. But his game grew. I mean, his ability to score off the bounce was not really there last year. He was just an outside shooter in most games that I saw. But if you took that away, then he was going to punish you another way. And it just kept getting better and better and better. And, yeah. You know, I think if he had been on a different Arkansas team that maybe had more parts, we wouldn't have seen all that. But it was because they needed it, and that his coaches drew up stuff for him and sets and let him take control of games. And that was a lucky break for Mason Jones.
Yeah, he talked yesterday about link prep, where he started out, and you referenced, yep, to. That's where he really developed his faith and his religion, his love for Jesus. And then he goes and plays at Connor State, which, I'm telling you, as far as junior college leagues, that's a great developmental league. There's a lot of great players in that league.
Tough league.
Tough league to – I mean, there's some tough – I mean, there are wars in that league. And Bill Muse is, as Ty was talking about earlier, one of the – veteran coaches, has been around a long time,
26 years
in that league, and you know, he knows what he's doing. And then he plays for Anderson, and then Musk. Here's a guy that has developed his game to this level, Clay, with a different head coach for 4 years. Now, generally, that lack of stability doesn't equal the success that he's had, but somehow, as you said, he's taken a little bit from everyone and turned that, what usually is a negative, four coaches in 4 years, into what's been a positive for him.
Yeah, I think he's a listener. I think he takes in everything and uses what, you know, what's best for him. And I think he'll continue to do that. And that will serve him well in the NBA, because it's seldom that you play for the same NBA coach. First of all, those guys are hired and fired in a day. And it's a revolving door in the NBA, both assistant coaches and head coaches. So he's that's not going to bother him. He's been through that. You date back to high school to now, that's five different coaches, I guess.
Yeah. And I was talking to Scott Edgar, who's a coach in that Oklahoma Junior College League. He coaches in Wilburton at Eastern Oklahoma. And I think, you know, while Bill Muse certainly has a connection with these schools, I think Scott Edgar was kind of backup, because I've discussed Mason Jones with him before, and he said he had talked to TJ back then and Mike, and he still has a relationship with those guys from years of coaching with Nolan, that he saw in those battles against Connor State what a player Mason Jones was, and knew that, you know, Arkansas could really get them something there. So I think not only did he have his head coach pushing for him and opening up doors, he had opponents' head coaches opening some doors for him with Arkansas back.
Yeah, and that happened, ago. Tommy, that's a great point. And that happened after just a few games, because because Mace was a 1 year guy at Connors, and that would have happened. That conversation would have happened in December, right after he'd played just a few games, because that's when TJ got in on him. You know, it was real early in his freshman year that he was like, okay, he's had a couple of games where he's gone off. You better get down there. Somebody is going to beat you to him. But they were first. Arkansas was first.
Yep, and I know some of these – well, the nature of these prep schools like Link Prep plays a lot of these junior college teams in November and December. So he probably had multiple exposures in that league to coaches seeing him, seeing his film. And that year at Link Prep probably helped open that door as well.
Good point, Tommy.
Clay, what's the food you couldn't live without? I know you were talking to us about your ribeye and your it was a ribeye and the shrimp and grits,
the
right?
The key to the ribeye, though, is it's a 2-inch thick bone-in ribeye, Clay. That's the key to
That's what it was. Yeah. That's what I've got in the freezer that our daughter Sarah is going to be here this weekend. She's a teacher in Rogers. I think she's had enough Zoom this week that she she would like a bone-in ribeye.
That's fair.
But the food that I couldn't live without, there isn't any question about it. It's a Little Debbie's oatmeal cream pie.
What about you?
You and Nick Saban.
Yeah. What's yours?
That ribeye that Clay's talking about would be a hard one to get by, but I think if it's just going to be a good old American junk food, probably nacho cheese Doritos.
Mine's pizza, and Mason has obviously had to improve his diet yesterday, and this will be the first kind of funny sound clip we play yesterday. Then we'll get into some more serious stuff, but this is what he said that he really hates he can't eat anymore to play.
Probably like fried chicken. You know, I used to love fried chicken, but, you know, now I've been moved to like fish, salmon, and, you know, Chipotle. Just, you know, I'm just trying to stay in shape and just keep doing things that that got me to the right way.
Chicken's more fun, though, isn't it?
Chicken is way more fun.
I couldn't live without fried chicken. I don't know about you guys. No, no,
I'm a fried chicken guy. Mm-hmm. I can tell you this, the night after both my daughters were born, I went and got, let's see, when the first one was born, the only fried chicken place that was close, this was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was Church's Fried Chicken. And I went and got there wasn't anybody else that was coming for a day or two, so I knew I was going to have to have some food in the refrigerator for a couple of more meals, and there wasn't time to cook it. I'm living by myself because my wife and daughter are obviously in the hospital, and so I bought an 8-pack of fried chicken from Church's. And then when our second was born, I went to Kentucky Fried Chicken for some fried chicken. I went and did the same thing. Got me a, I don't think it was a bucket. I think it was a box, you know, something like 6 to 8 pieces.
But there you go.
What'd you do the next day? That'd be my question, you know.
Have some cold chicken. Hey, the only thing better than hot chicken is cold chicken.
The 8 wouldn't have made it, you know.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Clay, one of the things he also talked about was the emotional side that he saw from Eric Musselman following the cancellation of the SEC tournament and eventually the NCAA tournament. Now, he mentioned that how he never thought that Eric Musselman, he would see him cry. But this was a really interesting piece of the conversation that we had with Mace yesterday.
I woke up and I had a little cough, and, you know, I told Mark. And Mark was like, well, I think they're going to cancel the tournament. I was like, what? And I told Jalen Harris, and we just in the same room. And they called us down to the meeting room, and Coach Musk started talking. And I never thought Coach Musk would cry. I never, with a day, I never thought I'd see a day Coach Musk cry. And the day, that was the day I seen Coach Musk cry, because you could see all the pain and Coach Musk, that he wanted it bad as we did. And, you know, as a players, we wanted it bad. We wanted to make a run. We wanted to make a statement. And we was all on 100 boards. We was all ready to go. Coach Musk didn't really have to say a lot. The coach staff didn't have to say a lot. We knew exactly what we wanted to do.
I mean, I know that was a big part of the conversation, that you felt like Arkansas had potential, maybe not to make it the championship in Nashville, but it was cut short with the cancellation of the SEC tournament, and we never saw what could have and maybe should have played out.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking, and it's, you know, and what you have to know is that happened all across the country. It didn't just happen with basketball. It was, you know, the Razorback women were track team. They were on their way to College Station. They thought they were going to win an NCAA championship. That's the one, to me, that where you look back and you say, what's the toughest break? When you're on you know, they were on a roll. They were perfectly healthy, which is what has to happen with the track team. They had all their bullets ready, and they were going to win an NCAA an indoor track championship. And that was, you know, that was snapped away. But it is so tough for a coach to tell an athlete that is done everything that you've asked them to do. They've done all the preparation. They've done all the academics. They've done, you know, they have laid it out for you, and then you tell them they can't play. That, you know, for no good reason, nothing that they had done wrong. You know, it's to have it snapped away. Now, I understand you know, why a coach would cry in that setting. And I bet you Lance Harder, Chris Bucknum, Brad McMakin, all these guys telling their athletes, you can't play. And well, we can't play this week. What about next week? No, it's over for this year. That'll make you cry.
You think Van Horn cried?
I don't know if he cried, but I bet he welled up inside.
Yeah, I bet.
So here's what I heard: it completely wrecked him, and that he couldn't stand. In other words, the players are all in their lockers. All of his speeches, he'd walk around the room and talk to them, and you know, in the center of the room, you know, it's a big rectangle room with lockers on all four sides. He took a chair and put it up in the middle of the room and just slumped in it. So that's raw emotion for him in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you put the work in, and just it's a sense of unfairness. I mean, because it's so out of your control. It's so not anyone's fault. It's just...
And you didn't see it coming.
You didn't see it coming. And again, I go back to something I say a lot. People don't get mad till they get something they don't expect. And no one expected this. I mean, as you say, didn't see it coming. But generally, when things derail your plans, there's someone to blame. There's something to blame. And now you just got this invisible virus out here. It's all you can blame it on. And it just, it'd be like you putting a whole magazine, the best magazine of your life together, but you can't print it. You know, well,
yeah,
great. You know, you'd be really unfair.
There's an unfairness to it, and also it's a blind side.
Mm-hmm.
They had their bags packed. The baseball team, their bags packed. They were going to get on the bus in literally just a few minutes and head to Starkville. They're going to get on the bus and bus over there. And, you know, it's like that's what they're there to go do. And then they're saying, no, we're not going, and we're not going to play. Well, you know, we may play. Now, the uncertainty of the season wasn't there yet. They were going to go home for a couple of weeks. I think that's what the message was. And then we'll reconvene a week after spring break and see where we're at. And, of course, it changed so rapidly, so quickly.
We've never dealt with anything like this. We're so used to, okay, a hurricane has come in and eliminated all the sports in South Florida or in the Gulf area, you know, or 9/11 happens and for 2 weeks everything is disheveled and sports are canceled. But in 2 weeks, we've never dealt with anything where we didn't know where the end point was, where the resumption was, where... Okay, we'll get back to normal in 2 to 3. We couldn't process a month ago that this was going to last months, not weeks. And it never seemed plausible to any of us that they're not going to cancel the entire baseball season. There's no way. Well, it became pretty clear within a week or two, there is a way, and that's exactly what they're going to do. It's exactly what happened. So you understand, going back to Mason Jones here, all these guys have put in the hard work. And, you know, you see their coach, and I'm glad that the fan base got to share in that with that video, and I'm glad Mason Jones talked with us yesterday about how it was received in that room.
Yeah, we kind of know the passion of the head coach right now, don't we? I mean, we've been up close and personal with those videos, and it reminds the emotion that you used to see. You know, I think the guy that brought the TV cameras in for the first time that really you saw the emotions that he was able to give to his players, those pregame speeches and halftime speeches with Houston Nutt.
Yeah,
so, and Eric Musselman's got some of that.
You hear that?
Yeah, he's got some of that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Definitely does. And you think about Mus, what he's provided for Mason and for so many other players. It's the feedback. It's the fact, hey, I've coached in the NBA. I've coached in the D-League. Now the G-League. I know a number of different things. And Clay Mason also touched on that yesterday.
Him just getting NBA feedback for me and him just helping me in all scenarios, just not for me coming back, but for me going too. So, you know, for a coach to actually help you and get a lot of feedback from teams,
is amazing. And all the coaches have been doing this. So, you know, it's always blessed to have coaches that's very invested in you and that's ready, that wants to see you have a good future. And, you know, Coach Musk is just, he's just a good, genuine man. You know, he does good things on and off the court. And he shows love for the players. And you, who wouldn't want to play hard for a coach that basically treats you like a pro before you go pro? And that's basically what he did for everybody this year. And you could tell that people respected him on and off the court, and he respected us. He gave us 110% every game, and that's all he wanted to do. And all he wanted to do was win. And that's really why I love him, because, you know, we both the same competitors. We wanted to win, and we wanted to do it at all costs.
I mean, that was a pretty good quote from Mace, wouldn't you say, Clay?
Yeah, and here's the thing, Ty. That is pure gold. It is pure gold for all the Arkansas players that are just about to sign. You know, the last, you know, I guess there's four committed. Three of them haven't signed yet. They're going to sign in the coming days. For them to know that their coach, and they're all going to sign. There's not one that's wavering.
Should be next Wednesday, hopefully. Yep, it's the first day.
And, you know, whether it's Moses, Moody, you know, just go down the list. And they're all 100% going to sign. The idea that he would help in that unbelievable way to make sure, you know, Mason could go follow his dream. You know, I've been around fans, and probably you guys have too, that are like, okay, you know, it's, what's Nolan going to tell the NBA scouts about Scotty? What's he going to tell them about Corey? We need those guys to come back. We don't need Michael mm-hmm. Qualls to be going to the NBA. You know, I just don't know a coach that has that in them. I mean, that's not what they're supposed to be doing. But there's a way of handling it, and then there's a way of making sure that your player is totally prepared for the NBA, and that's what Eric Musselman is about. And I think we get that now. And that clip from Mason Jones is 100% what you want your players to say about you when they're out the door.
Absolutely.
You
know?
Yeah. And he said it. He laid it all out there, how much help they were in – they know those NBA guys. I mean, it's like Clay Mosier. You just go down the list, all of them.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
He does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number three, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs!
Going to the phone lines where Jimmy Dykes is waiting on us, former coach of the Arkansas Razorbacks, current SEC Network analyst. Jimmy, thanks for making some time for us this morning.
Morning, guys. I hope you're well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. So, Coach, when you look, and we've talked to Sidney about this, we talked to Clay Henry about this, and I think you're probably going to share the same line of thinking as your former coach, Eddie Sutton, was selected for the Naismith Hall of Fame. It seems like everyone's really excited, or they just wish it would have happened earlier.
Yeah, I think, you know, those of us that I had the blessing of playing for him and coaching with him. And so I've been through it a lot of those days with Coach Sutton from Arkansas and Kentucky. I think we've always felt in our heart he was a Hall of Famer, but it's nice to finally have it validated like it was. I talked with the Sutton family last Friday night. When they had gotten the word that coach was going to be announced the next day. And it was a sweet moment for them as a family to be gathered together when they found out. And then I got to talk with coach the next day, probably 2 or 3 hours after the ceremony, and he can't communicate back, but I was able to, they put the phone up to his ear and I talked with him for 2 or 3 minutes and talked with Sean Sutton. So I've been very close to that family. I wouldn't be at ESPN like I am today without him in my background and, all the things he did for me in my coaching career that got me started. And it was just great to see Coach Sutton finally in there where he belongs.
Coach, when you look at him over the years, I know a lot of people really, really gave him credit for the defensive philosophy instilled with you guys over the years. But did he get enough credit for how he coached you guys offensively and when you coached alongside him, just his offensive game plan?
Yeah, he Yeah, he was great on both ends of the floor as a coach. You're right. Defensively, you know, you go to watch Bill Self practice at Kansas today, he's going to be doing the same defensive drills that Eddie Sutton did at Oklahoma State with Mr. Iba. And that goes all across college basketball. Those drills and that philosophy still run deep, deep today. The game's changed a little bit. There's more ball screen coverage you have to be concerned with. But the fundamentals of the game defensively for those teams that defend and win championships consistently, they trace their whole defensive backbone and heartbeat back to that man-to-man defense, help defense, all those things. But offensively, you know, Coach was a great motion offensive coach in his days at Arkansas, and then he changed when the talent changed at Kentucky and the game changed with a three-point line. He adjusted to that at Oklahoma State. He played fast. I think he kind of turned his offense over to Sean Sutton at the time there, and they really changed offensively. But the defense never wavered, and that still holds true today. I was talking yesterday about teams that could have made the Final Four and could have won it. And I mentioned Gonzaga was the number one offensive team in the country this year. I saw them in late February, and all the synergy numbers, all those things backed it up. But defensively, they were just outside the top 25, and no team in the last 10 years has won a national championship without a top 25 ranked defense. And I was anxious to see if Gonzaga could have done it this year. They were getting close to that number, but it just speaks to the fact that defense, at the end of the day, if you don't play it at a high level, you're not going to win, you know, conference championships, make a deep run in the NCAA tournament, national championships for sure. And that all goes back to those hard-nosed, tough, defensive-minded coaches like Eddie Sutton was back in the day.
Jimmy Dykes with us here on the Morning Rush. Got a new book out. I want to ask you about that. Film Doesn't Lie. I want to get into that before we get out of here. But you have a unique perspective. We've talked to Sydney, we've talked to former players here on the show about Coach Sutton from a player perspective, but you have the unique perspective of coaching with him as one of his assistant coaches. What was it like to be in those meeting rooms? What was he like as a head coach, as a mentor to a young coach like you back in the day?
Yeah, he was just as firm and tough and held people accountable in a staff meeting as he did on the court. But in the right way, you know, we worked hard as a staff. Back in those days, you know, there was just a ton of old time watching the film, putting the reel to reel on and watching it, rewinding it, making notes on yellow notebook paper and all those things. The recruiting wasn't quite as detailed or in depth that it is now. But he was a grinder, I guess is the best way to describe him. He loved to compete. We had a lot of great tennis matches as a staff in the summer. We'd go out and play tennis, and he hated to lose, and he didn't stack the team at all. He just hated to lose. But he was, you know, he was loyal, probably sometimes to a fault. He was so loyal to his staff and his former players, and he pretty much demanded that same loyalty back, and he got it for the most part. But he was a tremendous father figure to a lot of guys back then that didn't have that in their life. I was fortunate to have a fabulous father, and I still do, but a lot of guys didn't have it, and he stepped in and became that quickly and helped people to a whole new standard of how to work, how to treat people, how to be accountable in your life, and there's some great stories that came out of that. So he was a coach's coach, and he didn't mess around, and we were always prepared, and he had tremendous confidence as a coach. I can remember several times in halftime we'd be behind at Kentucky and walking out as a staff after the team had left to go back out for the second half. And I remember on two or three occasions he'd say, "Hey, we're okay, because I know I can out-coach the other guy." And he could, and that's the confidence that he had.
Jimmy, this week in talking to Ron Brewer, Pat Foster, James Dickey, Ron Brewer, Jimmy Counts, those guys, every one of them said that when they would stand on the floor during a timeout or a break or whatever, and they would look down at the other team, they knew they had an advantage. It's what you just said. They knew their guy was better than the other team's guy. And Jimmy Count says you just can't understand the great confidence that gives you as a player that your guy is the maestro. He's the, you know, the guy. And I don't think I've ever heard a player in any sport express that with such confidence. And you just said it just then. You know, it's to me, that's the worth of a coach, the essence of the whole deal with a player.
Yeah, Clay, you're right. He's, you know, he was, his words in a timeout, I mean, he could have told us something that just didn't make sense at all, but there was 100% belief in what he said. I think how he commanded a huddle, the confidence that he had. There was, he got input from his assistant coaches. I remember he would always have one assistant coach assigned each half to write down his thoughts during the half. And I can remember having that role as a graduate assistant for sure after I played for him at Arkansas. And he would say something to the team, and five or six times a half turn around to me and say, write that down. And I would write it down, and he would look at it at halftime before he talked to the team because he didn't want to forget those big moments. But he was, you know, he was kind of out there in front of the game in a lot of ways. But his number one strength was his knowledge of the game and his ability to convince us of his knowledge of the game. And it was never questioned. Like, all those guys are right that played for him and coached with him. Jimmy Counts was the same way as a player and a coach. He knows that there was never any game, no matter who we were up against, that we thought we were going to get out coached. We might get out played. We might have a bad shooting night, but we were never going to get out coached. That just never was even a thought. And I don't know how true that still holds today with student athletes, you know, with having that kind of supreme confidence in their guy.
Talking with Coach Jimmy Dykes here on the Morning Rush. Coach, no sports right now, but when we do get back into things, I know that you do stuff in studio, you do color commentating. Of the two, which do you enjoy more at your job at ESPN?
Yeah, I enjoy them both. You know, being in the studio gives me a big picture view of what's going on in college basketball, which is important in our job. But I still love the game. If I had to choose between the two, I still love the game. I love being at practice the day before and the day of, watching film with staffs. There's a ton of them out there. Just let me come in their film room with them and watch staff films or with their players. So I love that part of it, seeing the preparation. And just the day-to-day relationships that I have now with guys in this league in particular, like Rick Barnes is a tremendous friend of mine. Calipari's a really good friend of mine. Mike White at Florida, just a ton of them in this league I've developed really good friendships with because of the amount of time I've been in the SEC. But the games are special, man, and I was part of a really good crew this year with Carl Ravitch and Marty Smith on those ESPN Super Tuesday games, and it was sad to see it come to an end earlier than we all wanted to. We were in Bridgestone Arena in Nashville on Thursday getting ready for our noon game. I don't even know who it was. Looking back, I think it was Alabama and Tennessee. I know who it was getting ready to do that noon game on Thursday, and I was standing there with Calipari as his team was finishing up his practice because they didn't play till the next night, and we got the word, and he pulled his team over and told them, Get your stuff, get on the bus, going back to the hotel, get packed up. We're heading back to Lexington. We'll get ready for the NCAA tournament. And by the time that afternoon rolled around, there was no NCAA tournament. So the games went away a lot earlier than all of us wanted them to this year.
Coach, you mentioned Carl Ravitch. I got a chance to hear from him in Nashville when I was at a journalism college there at college. Really enjoyed listening to him speak. You mentioned being teamed alongside him. You were teamed alongside Brad Nessler when he was at ESPN. Of all the guys you've gotten to do play-by-play and you'd be the color guy for, who would you say you have the best chemistry with?
Oh, wow. It'd be those two guys you mentioned. I probably worked with 7 or 8 different play-by-play guys this past year, just off the top of my mind, looking back. And they at the ESPN level, they are all tremendous. Like, you just can't hardly pick one over the other. But because I was with Nessler so much for about a 7 or 8 year run, our chemistry was as good as it can be on the air. It was fabulous off the air, but on the air, we knew each other's thoughts. We knew exactly what where the other guy was going and when to talk, when not to talk, which is very, very important to have that chemistry as well. And I've developed that same chemistry with Carl Ravitch. This is my second full year with him on those Tuesday games on ESPN, and he's become a very good friend of mine off the air. He has a different style than Nestler did, but he's just as good in what he does. And that chemistry word you mentioned it's really important if you're going to be good to the viewer on the air, and you have to have a natural rhythm with them. I think the viewer has to realize these guys, they love what they're doing. They're having fun doing it. They like each other. They genuinely enjoy the conversation they're having with each other about the game. That's what makes it the best. And I think Carl Ravitch and Brad Nestler with me were the two best.
Jimmy, this is Clay. Mason Jones exploded this year. The jump that he made from last year to this year, just incredible. Is there some more in the tank that for him, you know, that would enable him to be at the next level what he was this year at the SEC?
Yeah, Clay, he was, first of all, Eric did a tremendous job of developing him, teaching him the game in terms of how to play with freedom. And that's a lot tougher than it sounds. Giving a guy a lot of freedom offensively, you got to teach him what does that look like. Like, what does that still look like for us? How do we play with freedom? How do we make sure we keep that proper spacing on the floor to allow that freedom to take place? And then how do you make plays out of those spots? And Mason was terrific at it. You know, he was an all-around scorer. You couldn't just take away his three-point line and crowd him out there, and then all of a sudden he became a 4, 5, or 6-point a game guy. He could score from everywhere. And I think for Mason, I was on the phone yesterday with two NBA scouts that asked specifically about him, and it's going to be about him continuing to develop his body, which he's done a fantastic job of doing that from where he was coming out of high school to where he is now. But the body, the explosiveness, the athleticism, all those things have to keep improving on those charts. But he's just a guy that's wired to score, and he's got a good size to him. He's a full 6'5". I think he's got that confidence that you need as a scorer to get it done at the NBA level. So it's going to be, can he defend where he needs to defend up there? Is he going to be explosive enough to continue to make those plays with the ball against NBA guys that he did in college and get them off balance? But he's got a lot to his game. And this is not just for Mason, but I look at a kid like Anthony Edwards at Georgia, who will probably go number one. I wouldn't take him number one, but he'll probably end up going number one. Has a fantastic body, but his body has to continue to get better. Same way with Zion Williamson last year and Ja Morant. That's that next step with their body is huge. And I knew it, but then this year I got to do one NBA game, the Lakers and the Nuggets. And the bodies on that floor compared to the bodies that I saw the night before during the Kentucky Vanderbilt game, it's night and day. And those kids don't realize it until they get in those camps, they get drafted, and they get in those workouts every day, and they realize where their body is and where it needs to be.
Jimmy, I want to ask you before you go about your book. Somehow you found time to write a book that's out and available. Is it available now where people can buy it online?
Yeah, it came out March 3rd. It took me the last two off seasons to get it done, and then I had last summer about 60 days to finish it off because they wanted it to be released during March Madness. My publishing company out of Chicago, they've done a great job with it. It came out on March 3rd. It was one of Amazon's top sellers that first 10 days it was out or whatever, and then the coronavirus shut us all down. So it's in all the bookstores out there, Barnes & Nobles, and all across the country, but those stores aren't open, so it's all being sold right now online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those things. It's available on my website at CoachJimmyDykes.com. And it's a sports-themed book, but it's a faith-based Christian book, really challenging the reader to a deeper, greater, just a more authentic walk with God, a more obedient walk with Him. I have a lot of really behind-the-scenes and I think interesting stories with players and coaches I've had over the last 23 or 4 years with ESPN, but I take those conversations and I quickly take our thoughts and our heart in that book to what does God say about this topic in our life, and and evaluating and really just asking the reader to create time and space in their heart to reflect on where they are and where they're going in some really key areas. So it's a Christian book. I think the timing of it is terrific for people right now that need hope and need an anchor in their life. And I know that book will point you in that direction.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.